Welcome to Lives, a show exploring our experiences in the world and how we might live well. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden, and my guest today is author Uche Okonkwo. We'll hear Okonkwo read from and talk about her debut book, A Kind of Madness, a collection of short stories set in Nigeria that explore the intricacies of human relationships and desires, our flawed thinking, religious and cultural norms, and the erosion of childhood innocence. Okonkwo also shares her own growth as an author and as a person.
There was a time in my life when I tried to only write happy stories. And that period did not last very long because I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't keep abandoning all my ideas because they weren't happy enough. So I just decided to go with it.
Uche Okonkwo is a writer whose stories have been published in a public space. One story, The Kenyon Review, Plowshares, The Best American Non-Required Reading 2019, and Lagos Noir, among others. A former Bernard O'Keefe scholar at Breadloaf Writers Conference and resident at Art Omai, she is a recipient of the George Bennett Fellowship at Phillips Exeter Academy, a Steinbeck Fellowship, and an Elizabeth George Foundation grant. Okonkwo grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, and is currently pursuing a creative writing PhD at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Her debut short story collection, A Kind of Madness, published by Tin House, is now available. Uche Okonkwo, welcome to Lives.
Thank you, Stuart. It's great to be here.
I'd love to get a sense of you as a person, and I'd love to start by asking you, what was your childhood like? What is it that stands out to you from your childhood?
So I grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, and I'm the third out of five daughters of my parents. So what stands out to me about my childhood? Being surrounded by a lot of women, I suppose. Although my younger sisters, there's a bit of an age gap, so I was the last child for a while. Something else that stands out is being surrounded by a lot of books, because both of my parents studied English at university, at different universities. And so the house was filled with my parents' books from school. A lot of them had two copies, one from my dad and one from my mom. So yeah, I grew up surrounded by books. I started reading my parents' books pretty early. I wouldn't say I understood most of what I read, but I also did read a lot of stuff that was not age appropriate. That's one of the distinct memories from childhood, is being surrounded by books and hiding, because I was still kind of like very, very introverted. And I liked my space and my alone time, so I would like go hide under the table, dining table, and just like read and sometimes write stuff and just watch people just be weird under the table. So, yeah.
Is that a feature of being the middle of five siblings, that you can withdraw, hide a little bit? I don't know.
It could be. I was the last for, I don't know, was it 5 or 7 years? I have to always do the math to like figure out the age gap between me and my sisters. But the first three of us were pretty close in age, and then the last two, there was more of a gap. So I was the last for a while. But yeah, I think by the time my other sisters came along, it was easier to hide, I think, and just be not noticed as much.
Tell me about some of the books that you mentioned, and you jokingly said maybe some of them weren't age appropriate, but it sounds like, I don't know how inspired you were by reading. So what were some of the books you found yourself, you know, intrigued by?
So a lot of them were books from like the like African writers that my parents were studying. So people like Chinua Achebe, Ama Ata Aido, Ayikwe Amar, some of the pioneering African writers back in the day, some of whom are still alive, the university texts that my parents were reading. Some of the less age-appropriate ones were things like, I remember Sidney Sheldon, a few Sydney Sheldon books having like some sex scenes like that I probably shouldn't have been reading at the time. And then there's this James Hadley Chase. I think he used to write thrillers, but they all had these kinds of like scandalous looking covers with like half naked women and things like that on the cover. I don't even remember what they were about, but I remember that they were like thrillers and they kind of had some content that I probably shouldn't have been reading.
As we'll come to in your book, relationships between family members, relationships between people that are close to you, friends and strangers too, is a consistent theme throughout the book. So I'm just curious about, you know, the relationship between you and your sisters.
I would say we were closer growing up, probably up to an extent. But by the time we hit secondary school, my two older sisters went off to, we all went to boarding schools. My two older sisters went off to a boarding school together, the same school. I went to a different school all by myself. My younger sisters would have still been in primary for like a few years. So I think that point was maybe where some separation was like starting to happen, because I was in my school by myself. Of course, we would reconnect during the holidays, but my two older sisters had their own shared experiences together at their school, and I was by myself at this other school. Yeah, and my two younger sisters, I think also the age gap between me and them, we were not super close. Right now, my sisters and I are not super close. We're not estranged or anything. We talk, we are in communication with each other, but we're not like intensely close the way sisters can be, which is kind of sad. I will say that like in the last year or two, my youngest sister has become like closer to me in a way I would not have imagined, just because, I mean, by the time I left home for like university, she was still so much younger that we didn't have that much to relate on. And because of our age gap, there hasn't been a lot of opportunity for us to like feel super close. But I think like in the last 2 years or so, getting to know her as an adult has been very interesting. It almost feels like she's a different person, but in a way we have a lot of like shared values and shared beliefs. So there are things about my life that I can tell my youngest sister that I cannot tell anybody else in the family, just because we have a lot in common in the way that we think. And so it's been an interesting evolution in those relationships.
You mentioned boarding school. What was your boarding school experience like?
I was there for 6 years. The first 3 years were a lot more difficult than the last 3 years. Just because coming into a boarding school at the lowest class, you are like the bottom of the pecking order. Everybody has power against over you, from the teachers to staff to prefects to all the other senior students. Like anybody in the class above you has the power to like make you do stuff, like send you on errands, ask you to do things, bully you to an extent. Going into that school from like the junior one class was really rough, even though I did have like a school mother who was very popular and was in one of the senior classes. But it was still rough. And I did something when I was in my first year at that school that kind of made me a little bit of a pariah. I got myself into trouble. So I had this school mother, and because of her, I was protected to an extent, but I could see what the other junior students were going through, and I got an idea that I was going to do something about it. I don't think of myself as a particularly courageous person, so I did the thing that I thought was in my wheelhouse to do, which is to write something. So we had this weekly assembly that we would do at school. It was called Hour of Doom, and it was run by this one of the boarding house staff. And so the purpose of this assembly was to call out the names of people who had committed various offenses around the school that week, including littering. One thing I will give that school credit for is that I cannot litter because of my 6 years in that school. So this senior boarding house master, he had like this organization in the school. and its members were secret. Like, you didn't know who was in this organization. And so they were the ones who would, like, be kind of as spies, like, gathering names of people who had done all kinds of stuff during the week. And then they would submit the names, and then they would be called out in the assembly. And for people who were caught littering, they would have to, like, carry this bucket, the bucket of doom, and kind of dance around the assembly as part of their punishment. Anyway, so my idea was to write a letter that would be read out at this assembly. I put it in the suggestion box anonymously. And so to write this letter, I had gone around kind of secretly, but not so secretly, asking all the other junior students, like, who are the worst, like, offenders amongst the senior students in your dorms. And so I had this list of names. And then I wrote this letter. And with the letter, I had written also, like, these dramatic scenes of, like, examples of the things that seniors were doing. And so it got read on the assembly, and, like, everybody was laughing at the scenarios that I had written. And then I was kind of also didn't do myself any favors. I was, like, kind of, like, whispering to the people around me. And of course, the people I had asked for names also, like, remembered that I had gone around asking them for names. So these seniors were kind of punished. And then, of course, it eventually was revealed that I was the one who did it. Ooh. Yeah, that was not a great time for me. Yeah, it was a lot of, like, punishments. Like, they would pass me around, like, oh, they're like, when you're done with her, like, bring her to our dorm. So, like, it was weeks of, like, just going around the different dorms, like, serving all kinds of punishments until, like, the seniors were satisfied and they eventually left me alone. And my school mother could not save me from that. Yeah. So, yeah, it was not fun. But it was also, like, it wasn't all bad. I learned not to litter, and I had some good experiences, I suppose. But for the first 3 years, it was really rough. I used to cry every time I was getting dropped off at school. My mom got really worried at some point, but I was there for 6 years. It's given me a lot of material for stories, say that much.
It feels to me pretty evident from the stories you shared that reading was a key part of your development as a child and then a young adult, and writing also seemed to show up, and that example was fun, but also, let me just call it a learning experience. When did you actually realize that writing was something that was intrinsic to who you think of yourself as a person?
I started writing from very young, so I think it was always part of my identity. But I think I started taking it seriously as work after 2011. And in 2011, I was selected to participate in this workshop that in Lagos that Chimamanda Adichie runs every year. After that workshop, that was the first time that I really felt like, oh, okay, this is more than just a hobby. I think before then I had been thinking of it as something I enjoyed doing, as, like, a hobby. But after that, I started to think of it as, okay, maybe this is something I should be taking more seriously and try to do more with it. Although I had always kind of, like, gone in the direction of writing. I studied English also in school, English education. Even though I had wanted to study psychology. And then after graduating, I worked as an intern at a publishing company in Lagos. I worked there for many, many years, up until managing editor before I left Nigeria. So I had always kind of been in that work.
Is writing that different to psychology, now I think about it from this perspective?
Maybe not that much. And maybe that this is why I was kind of interested in psychology, even as something to study in school. I think there's a lot of observation that you need to do to be able to write convincingly. And I think that psychology is probably similar, like understanding human nature and, like, human experiences. I think they go hand in hand. So it made sense to me to want to study psychology.
A Kind of Madness, that's the title for the book. The title itself came later, as it were, than the stories, and you were sort of searching for a title. And my understanding is that madness, as we might understand it, as a profound, definable mental illness, isn't really what you're writing about. It's more about flawed thinking. But could you share a little bit more about the genesis of the title, why this collection of stories is called A Kind of Madness?
Yeah, as you've probably gathered from the interviews and other stuff I've been doing, it was a little bit of a struggle to come up with a title for this book, because I had looked at the titles of the individual stories and I didn't like any of them as a title for a book. And so I had to think of something else. And so I was looking at all the stories and trying to see if I could find like a sentence or a phrase that felt like it could say something about the book as a whole. And so A Kind of Madness emerged from the very first story in the collection, where a daughter is confronting her mother, well, confronting to the little extent that she can, about her choices and their choices together. And then she says something like, oh, this is madness. Like the fact that my mom still cannot see where we went wrong in this whole situation. And it just felt like something that I could kind of pinpoint in every story, like that there's like a moment of realization or a thread of just bad choices informed by like bad thinking. But again, very human choices and human motivations and understandable. So madness in that sense, not as a literal kind of madness, but just way of thinking, way of being.
For the listener who is just about to dash to their local independent bookstore to buy this book, how would you describe what they're going to find when they sort of pick this book off the shelf?
First of all, a beautiful cover. Yeah, I think the cover is great. I am biased, but I do think it's great. Well, inside, stories about different Nigerians making their way through life, confronting the difficulties of Nigerian society. But like you say, a lot of these conflicts and struggles are universal, but with a uniquely Nigerian perspective and Nigerian twist. So it's a book of short stories. So each one is its own little world, but all the stories, you can see the connections between all the themes. And it's a good, I think, a good introduction for someone who hasn't read fiction from Nigerians or contemporary Nigerians. I think it's a good one to dive into, if I say so myself.
You talked about this having a Nigerian texture, a Nigerian flavor. All of the stories are set in Nigeria. Could you talk a little bit more about why they're set in Nigeria and what you were hoping to accomplish for the reader by using these pictures and portraits and experiences grounded in that culture and country?
So yeah, they are set in Nigeria because it's the place I know best. I grew up there. I've lived there my whole life until, 2017, which is still like fairly recent. So yeah, it's the place I know best. And when I was writing the stories, I wasn't writing them with the idea that they would be a book, like not necessarily. Some of the oldest stories from the collection are like 10 years old. At that point, I was still just writing stories to see where things would go. Some of them have ended up in this book. So it's kind of hard to talk about like a goal that was driving the book. If I can answer that question, it would maybe be like at the point of putting the stories together, which was a lot more recent. I guess the goal is to share something. I hesitate to ascribe a lot of deliberate intention just because there's so little of this process that is within my control. What's within my control is the actual writing of the book, how it's received, how it affects people is a lot less within my control. But I like to think of it as trying to say something to someone and hopefully leaving them with something that feels that they have like a little island of a thing that they can keep to themselves. if there's any hope that I have when I write stories, is to not bore the reader. I think that's like the criticism I'm most afraid of with my writing is, oh, it was boring. That would be the worst thing I could hear. But just I'm just always trying to like share a moment, share some of those difficult or unanswerable questions, and just have someone to like sit with for a period of time while you have the book, and maybe take something with you when you close it. I know that's like very it's not tangible, but yeah, it's not.
After our conversation today, you're going to a reading at Dundee Book Co. And you've been doing and are continuing to do readings and tours as you share the book with communities across the country. Are there moments when you're engaging with a reader where you do get that feedback that tells you how readers are reacting, responding, completing the work in some ways?
Yes. I've been hearing from like friends who have read the book about what stories are their favorites and why. That has been very special, because I hear sometimes the most unexpected things. I think somebody had talked about, my friend Ivy had mentioned The Harvest, and she kind of compared it to like the ending of Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin. And I was like, wow, can we be compared to James Baldwin? But also, there are moments when I'm reading to an audience and I hear unexpected laughter. And it's like, okay, so that's funny to some people. Some moments where like I didn't expect that anybody would find it funny. I did not intend it to be funny, but it's funny. So those moments are always interesting to have. I imagine that there will be more. People say it's funny. People say it's dark. I think both of those things are accurate.
Off air, we were speaking a little bit about your connection with Nigeria. You've had some professional roles there in the publishing industry, that sort of thing. But you were sharing with me that it's one thing having the book published here, but it also was really important to you that it found a welcoming, supportive home in Nigeria too. Would you share just a little bit more about that feeling, that desire that you had?
So all the stories are set in Nigeria. All the characters are very Nigerian. The issues are unique to Nigeria, but also not. Also, I'm Nigerian, and like I have worked in publishing in Nigeria. I feel like I have all these connections. I know the Nigerian publishing landscape. I know most of the people who are running the publishing companies. We might not necessarily be friends, but we know each other. We've been in that work for years and years. I think it would have really felt so disappointing if I hadn't found a publisher in Nigeria, because I felt like that would have said something about something about the work, and not a good thing. If no Nigerian publisher was willing to take it, I would have been like, what, did I do something wrong? And not necessarily so. It could just be that short stories are harder to sell, as everyone says, which is also true. I don't know. It could have been any reason. There aren't a ton of publishers in Nigeria, so the options are even a lot more limited than like the US or even the UK. So a Nigerian not getting a book deal in Nigeria is not necessarily an indictment on the writing. But I know that my head would have been saying that, but in my heart it would have felt so bad, because it would feel as if like my home has rejected my work in a way. And that would have been so horrible. So I'm really glad that we found a Nigerian publisher.
This feels like the right time to invite you to read something, if that's okay, just to allow our listener into, as it were, a little bit of a feel of the book style and what you're writing about. So is there something that comes to your mind that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yes. Okay, I'm going to read something from Eden. I won't be reading from the opening. So just to give a little bit of context for it, in this story, we have a brother and a sister. The boy is Madu, he's 10 years old. And Ifechi, the girl, is 7 years old. And they have discovered their father's stash of pornography. The story is set in the 90s. So we're talking VCRs with the cassette tapes. So they've started making their way through their father's stack of VCR tapes. And at this point in the story, they're kind of experiencing the effects of that and that loss of innocence. This section is told from Ifechi's perspective. Ifechi is the girl. One rainy night when there was no electricity, the children played catch the light with their father. Their mother lay on the couch, laughing and shouting warnings. Catch the light was their game, invented by their father for nights like this, when electricity was gone and stomachs were full and the silence in the room had no extra weight to it. He would put out the candles and let the warm darkness surround them. Then he would turn on his flashlight and move the beam of light on the floor and all around the room, the children scrambling to touch it with their hands or feet. It was the only game they played together. The stakes were high on this night. Their father had promised the winner 3 over-the-head spins to be redeemed at any time of the winner's choosing. Madu and Ifechi loved being held above the head of their tall father, loved opening their eyes to see the furniture, barely discernible in the dark, whirling around them. A dizzying sensation remained after they were set down gently, like honey lingering on their tongues. But most of all, they loved the chafing feel of their father's palms as he gripped them, and they imagined that his hands left an imprint that remained long after he let go. The children rushed from spot to spot, shrieking and stretching their limbs towards the light. But just when they thought they'd got it, the light would move away and they would laugh out their frustration. The light was all they could see, and they followed wherever it went, sometimes bumping into each other and their father. One time, their father directed the beam of light to a spot close to his feet. Ifechi followed, but instead of chasing the light, her eyes landed on her father's right foot. The nail of his big toe was long, yellow from the light. Specks of dirt or lint stuck in the corners where nail met skin. Ifechi could not move. In one of her father's films, a man had moaned in ecstasy while he kissed and nibbled on a woman's foot, sucked on the dainty toes with their red nail polish, opened his mouth wide as half of the woman's foot vanished into it. Ifechi felt her heart pounding as she pulled her eyes away from her father's foot. She glanced at her mother's dark form on the couch. Had her mother's feet ever disappeared into the mouth of her father like that? Like prey being consumed by a python? Had her father made sounds just like the man in the film, like he was dying but didn't want it to stop? Ifechi tried to find her father's face in the gloom, certain that he knew what she was thinking, what she and Madu had done. But he was still moving the light, and Madu was still running and screaming. Everything felt normal. When their father was ready to let someone win, it was Madu who was chosen. Madu and their father spun together, their laughter filling the empty spaces in the room, while Ifechi watched with remorse from her place on the ground.
Thank you for sharing that. Many of your stories relate to children, that they have children as the main characters, or they're perceived through the eyes of children. Why that particular focal point?
I think I'm very interested in children because of that tension between what the reader, who's typically an adult, knows versus what the child knows. I think there's a lot of room to play with that kind of imbalance in terms of life experience and knowledge. And it can be, I think it has a lot of potential for tension and making a story really insightful when you think about the ways in which children misunderstand things, but also understand things in ways that we would not expect. So I think there's a lot of potential there for like subverting readers' expectations. Also, a friend of mine thinks that I'm trying to relive my childhood by writing all these stories about children, which might be true. I don't know.
I think we all have a massive capacity for playful, imaginative stretching of the mind. But I think children aren't hindered by social norms or expectations or as much shame or embarrassment, you know, putting childish things away, as it were. And it feels to me that maybe Burning is a good example of this. And another story, the title of which I forget, but, oh, Shadow. And the children, I think, have this remarkable capacity to think so wildly imaginatively, even if a little self-centeredly on occasion. But I don't know if that's also something that you could play with, this idea that kids have wild imaginations and adults sometimes just erect barriers.
Yeah. Writing about childhood gives you also an opportunity to see how we then force children in line, like kind of tamp down on that like wild childlike imagination, whether we're doing that intentionally or not. I think also it can be very interesting the ways that children are selfish, like you said, and cruel. Where that comes from, where they learn it from, and how they use it, or how and when they choose to use it, because children can be cruel sometimes in ways that they don't even realize. So that tension between the innocence and the cruelty and the stuff that they are learning and unlearning can be very interesting to work with.
It's not a book about faith or religious belief, or strictly speaking, cultural mythologies. But nonetheless, the characters find themselves in situations where those are aspects of the story of their life. Given that you are a writer, but also a person that has experienced many different cultures as part of your academic and professional growth, I'm curious to what extent you were exploring how you found the world in both religious and sort of mythological and cultural terms through some of the ways you examined these stories.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that is happening, I would say, particularly with religion, because my own relationship with my faith is like kind of, it's complicated. I don't think there's a chance that my mom will listen to this show, but I've talked about faith in like previous interviews and just how coming to the U.S., I wouldn't say it was coming to the U.S. that changed my relationship with faith. I think that was already happening even before I left Nigeria, but something about coming to the U.S. maybe accelerated it a little bit, just because of there are certain expectations that you have growing up. Like growing up in Nigeria, we had this impression of the U.S. Like it was this, it's very progressive, and like the politics is not about religion the way it can often be in Nigeria. And then coming here, and I came in 2017, so with all that stuff that was happening, but even to find that it's been a huge part of American history, and that's something I didn't know growing up in Nigeria, because we don't learn a lot of American history. So I think coming to the U.S. definitely did change my relationship to faith. But yeah, I'm constantly exploring that relationship in the stories. Nigeria is it's a very religious country. The major religions are Islam and Christianity. And it's interesting to see the overlaps, but the places also where we diverge. In how it's practiced here versus in Nigeria. A lot of overlap, surprisingly. There's always that tension in the stories, because I think pretty much all the stories have some element of that kind of religion conversation, even if it's not explicit or the main theme. It's kind of always there. It's something I'm interested in exploring even more. But yeah, it's complicated thing, I would say.
As well as religion, there are those norms about how we relate and what society expects from us too. These value systems, and sometimes they can be grounding and comforting, and at other times they can feel claustrophobic and very dated. And so one example of that, I think, is the first story, and a mother forces the break off of one engagement for her daughter in favor of what appears to be a better marriage, which I won't describe how this goes, but I think what's important here are the expectations around how relationships exist between mothers and daughters or families and daughters, what those cultural norms are around the expectations about power and duty, and what makes for a good life. Like this, I'm sure this mother is planning, hoping for the best life for her daughter. So I'm curious, again, given that you have had a rich experience in life exploring different cultures, different norms, again, what you're trying to explore in terms of those relationships between people and relationships with cultural expectations.
Yeah, speaking of cultural expectations, I think, I have experienced like living in different places, but I don't feel immersed enough that I can really comment on cultural expectations in other places in my writing yet. I'm getting there. And so this is why a lot of my focus when I write about cultures and when I write about anything, to be honest, is still within the Nigerian context because it feels most familiar to me. Expectations are a big part of the work that I do and what I write about, particularly expectations when it comes to like women and like gender norms. I think that it's so interesting to think about. This is 2024. So many things have changed, but at the same time, so many things have not changed. So it's interesting to explore those tensions. That happened in the first story in the book, Unye Belgium. Animals is another story that I think also really plays with those expectations a lot. That was one story I really enjoyed writing, I think. Yeah, I think it was probably one of the ones I had the most fun writing is Animals. And I think one of the reasons, again, is that what is expected of men, what is expected of women, how are you expected to perform these different roles in a way that feels true to yourself, but also authentic to what people expect? So it's a constant battle. Sometimes you can't win.
You shared earlier that it feels like all of the characters throughout the book have some moment, especially the children, have some moment of realization, some opening of their mind to a different way to see the world. And I wouldn't necessarily call that dark. I certainly wouldn't call it light, but it's something that feels true and universal to human growth. That being said, how do you feel about the nature of the focus of these stories? Is there a focus towards our human anxieties? Is there something joyful in these pieces?
A lot of the stories do lean towards like the darkness. I don't think there's any story in the book that is, actually, maybe I'm wrong about that, because I think Unye Belgium, even with the way it ends, is kind of probably maybe the most kind of comedic in a way. I've had a lot of people say that. But I think my tendency is to lean more towards the troubling, maybe not dark all the time, but definitely troubling, those places where questions and discomfort come from. So yeah, I said in one interview that there was a time in my life when I tried to only write happy stories. And that period did not last very long because I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't keep abandoning all my ideas because they weren't happy enough. So I just decided to go with it. But even with the stories that are challenging and dark, I think particularly when children are involved, I think it's important that it's not just about what's disturbing and what's dark, but in the process of going through that, it's important for the characters to have, first of all, like moments of agency. even if it's only in their head, just moments where they feel like they have some measure of control. And hopefully by the end of the story, bring them to a place where they're on the cusp of like a realization that changes things for them a little bit, maybe makes their life a little more bearable. I'm thinking now of Debris, which is not a happy story, but by the end, we have this moment where this boy is just taking charge and he's going to get his food no matter what. So just things like that, where in the midst of trouble and darkness, there are moments of like agency and assertiveness.
The stories were created over, say, a period of a decade, give or take. And I don't know the degree to which you repolished, refined, adapted any of them as part of pulling them into the collection that is the book, A Kind of Madness. So I'm curious about that. And I'm curious about the act of curating these stories. I don't know if placing yourself in a curatorial role in gathering these stories, organizing them, the order that they appear in the book, I don't know if that changed your relationship between you and the stories.
I think time has changed my relationship between me and some of the stories. So my current favorite stories in the collection are the more recent ones, just because they feel closer to who I am now as a person. But even some of the older ones, even though they felt less like me today, but there was still enough me in them where it felt like, okay, they still belong in the collection. There's some stories that were in the manuscript I first submitted to my agent back in 2017 that did not make it into the collection. There are some stories in there that were not written in 2017 that are a lot more recent, like in the last few years. Animals is one of them, which I think, again, is why it's one of my current favorites. But yeah, the process of putting them together for the collection did change some of them, especially the older ones. For example, a story like Shadow. I think Shadow was published in maybe 2016 or 17 for the first time. Shadow has really changed from when it was first published. Right now, it has a current structure of like part one and two and three. It didn't have that when it was first published. Shadow has been through a lot of workshops even after it was first published. So it's been a lot of revision and rethinking of that particular story. Some of the others, not so much. But yeah, putting the stories together in a collection definitely changed how I saw them, because reading them together in a single manuscript, you begin to see how they are speaking to each other. There was even a moment when I was considering making them linked stories. I ended up abandoning that idea. I don't remember exactly why, but it feels right because I didn't have that intention for them. And it just didn't feel like they needed to be connected. But yeah, putting them together, you see the relationships between each other. I also saw the things that I had a tendency to repeat from one story to the next. Not anything major, but like little phrases here and there that when I read everything together as a whole, I was like, oh, didn't I say that two stories ago? And two stories ago might have been a story that I wrote in 2016. So then you put them together and you see that you have these obsessions or these like pet phrases that you return to, or little images that I carry from one to the next. So part of the process of revising and editing the manuscript was getting rid of those things. But yeah, it was an eye-opening experience. In terms of the arrangement of the stories, this was a group decision, the arrangement of the stories. So me and my agent had this conversation first early on before she started submitting the manuscript to publishers. So we had an order that we had decided on for submission to publishers. And then in the process of editing with the publisher, we decided on a different order. But there were a few things that remained the same. I think Burning was always either the last story or the first story. So we knew that Burning had to have a place like that where it was either the last or the first. We decided on last because we felt like Burning had that like resonant kind of feel where it will stay with you after you close the book. And that felt like a good note to end on.
How are you a different person as you look back on, for example, you know, how you wrote, what you wrote about before? How have you become a different person?
You mean particularly with the writing?
Let's start with the writing and then we'll expand it to you.
With the writing. I feel like the writing one is the more difficult one to answer. It's one of my little unspoken anxieties is that maybe I'm not changing enough as a writer. A lot of the things that I liked to write about, I still really like to write about. Like, it's a lot of the same subject. It's about families and relationships, and I like to write realist fiction. I have tried my hands at more speculative stuff because I admire a lot of speculative fiction, but it seems like my brain so far just can't do that. So I do a lot of realist fiction about families and dysfunction and relationships and like women's issues. And it's still all the same things that I like to write about and read about. And so I worry that like I'm not diversifying enough. Maybe I'm a one-trick pony. But with the writing, it's hard to say because I don't know if I have changed all that much. I do think that maybe one thing I'm getting, I don't want to make this sound like a judgment, like saying that the longer form is better than short form writing. I don't think that's the case. But I think I'm getting better at writing longer pieces. I still very much identify myself as a short story writer. I have attempted novels, but they've never been anything worth like showing anybody even. But yeah, I've gotten better at like writing longer short stories. And then how I've changed as a person, I'm a lot less willing to criticize, particularly other writers. I feel like growing older and just life in general has really humbled me to the point where like I almost will not say a bad word about anybody's writing in public anywhere. Like if I'm talking to a very close friend and it's a private conversation, sure, maybe. But yeah, I just find it so hard now to be mean about anybody else's work. I mean, it's one thing if they are doing something that's like racist or sexist, that kind of stuff. But if it's just on the level of like craft differences or like personal preferences, those kinds of things, I'm a lot less likely to be harshly critical than I was like years ago. I think the whole process has given me more of an appreciation for how much hard work goes into it, how much luck goes into it, how much is just out of your control. And how much your life circumstances can affect whether you're able to work or not. Like there's just so much that we don't get to control. So it's just hard now to harshly like criticize anybody's like work.
Off air, we spoke about, it's a tiny similarity, but the Midwest isn't our place of birth. So we've both come from different places.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if you have any sense of maybe not even homesickness, but maybe homesickness, but in particular, any sense of rootlessness, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like since 2017, which was when I got here. Yeah. Just knowing that. And being a student in the U.S., being an international student, it's kind of a transitional state to be in. And I've been in that state for 7 years. So, yeah, it feels like, it feels unsettling in a way. Like, right now I'm in Lincoln, Nebraska. I don't know where I'm going when I finish the degree or how long I will be there. Well, yeah, I do feel that sense of I wish I was in a more like stable place where I could think. Well, I've never been able to think more than like 2 or 3 years ahead, but maybe that comes from also just moving a bit. But yeah, I do feel that sense of rootlessness and very much homesickness. But it comes and goes. It was very difficult when I first got to the US. I almost quit the MFA and went back home. Just because, I don't know, it felt so different and so lonely. I was in Blacksburg, Virginia, this like small town. And I had come from Lagos, which is like just so crowded and noisy and overwhelming. But yeah, so it was a huge adjustment period. I do feel homesick. I'm better able to cope with it now. I think I've been here long enough that it feels it's less painful when it happens.
What is next in your writing and in your life?
In the writing, I'm working on something that I don't know what it is yet. Right now, it feels like it's like a novella or a short novel. It's about a woman whose pregnancy becomes like a chronic thing that doesn't quite end when it's supposed to end. But yeah, that's the project I'm going to return to when I go back to writing, because I haven't been writing for a while. What comes next in life? I need to finish this PhD. So I need to do the things I need to do to finish it. And then I guess I will be going on the job market and seeing what happens next. It's a huge question mark when it comes to like what's next in life. It's unfolding.
As we look to close our conversation, is there a final piece that you'd be willing to read for us?
Yeah, I can read something from Burning. So this is the last story in the collection, and it's about a mother and a daughter who are like trapped in a strange and painful cycle, mostly from the mother's doing. Adanda knows her mother's faces. There is a face for the days when she wakes up with a light in her eyes, and they eat and they stay home eating sweet balls of puff puff. Batches and batches pouring out of her mother's pan and forming small hills on every surface in the kitchen. On days like this, they rewatch her mother's collection of Nollywood films, in which good and evil are separate like oil and water, and justice comes swift from heaven in the form of lightning. On other happy days, they visit Tedju Osho Market and make their way through a maze of clothes shops. Male traders whistling at their backsides and grabbing at their arms, and Adana's mother throwing smiles at them over her shoulder while Adana tries to shrink herself to nothing. When they return home with piles of clothes, Adana's mother says with a conspiratorial wink, "Good thing it's your grandfather's money paying for all this." There come the days when her mother is unable to drag herself out of bed. On these days, her face is pale with fear, her eyes darting at the slightest sound. Adana's mother buries this face in a pillow and refuses to get up, and Adana makes her own breakfast, a cup of Milo and two slices of bread, and eats it standing in the quiet kitchenette. Then, in the bedroom she and her mother share, she puts on her blue shirt and pink pinafore and heads for the front door, hoping to hear her mother's voice call out at the last moment with an offering, to walk with her maybe, or a promise to be there when the bell rang at the end of the school day. One time, her mother did call out to her from under the bedding, told Adana to hold on as she put on a t-shirt and tied a wrapper around her waist. She took Adana's hand along with a deep breath, and they walked out the door together. The pressure of her mother's grip, the quiet slapping of her slippers against her feet, made up for those mornings Adana had walked alone. With her mother holding her hand, Adana would not have to tug at strangers' sleeves at the busy junction and ask for help to cross the road. But barely halfway to school, her mother's fingers went limp and let go of Adana's. Her mother sank, squatting in the street and burying her face in her hands. Adana stood stunned, feeling naked as strangers stared at them. She wanted to keep walking and ignore the anchor pulling her down, pretend that the moaning ball of flesh had no connection to her. She resisted the urge to scream at her mother, at the sky, at all the people watching them but moving on, minding their business. Instead, she knelt on the warm asphalt and rubbed her mother's back in circles around and around. The noise of traffic and hawkers and conversation faded until all she could hear was her mother's muffled sobbing. When Adanna's mother stood again, it was Adanna's hand holding hers, guiding her back home.
My guest today has been writer Uche Okonkwo. Uche, this has been a real delight. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.